Once upon a time, before the internet, before downloading, there was a golden age when people bought all of their music at record stores. Oftentimes, these record stores became places where people would congregate, get turned on to new ideas, and just hang out. They became the nexus point for kids that may not have fit in. The weirdos, the malcontents. Trash American Style was one such store that existed first in Brookfield and later in Danbury, Connecticut. Malcolm and Kathy, the owners, are two of the most radical people I've ever known. I can't even begin to calculate how many hours and gallons of coffee I logged in hanging out there, getting turned on to new music, talking to the cast of characters that worked there, discovering new bands. It opened me up to things I would have never been exposed to if I played it safe. I want to emphasize that the closing of Trash wasn't brought on by financial hardship, but instead by greed and deceit. Ultimately, it was the underhanded, cowardly methods of Minuteman Press, Trash's neighbor, coupled with the landlord's refusal to renew their lease that did them in. A great documentary called I Need That Record summarizes the entire saga. Despite this, the story continues. Malcolm and Kathy, faced with the obstacle of their store closing, decided to take it on the road and travel with the store, taking it to the people. This is one of the primary lessons I learned from the Trash American Style crew. Refusal to give up, to choose your path and stick with it despite everything else. That's why Malcolm will always be the man. I caught up with Malcolm in the parking lot of Heirloom Arts Theater in Danbury this past weekend. The occasion was an adrenaline overdose show. The parking lot was filled with old punks and younger kids. Malcolm rolled up with his distro and we talked.
Any more hell breaks sure. loose.
So I already have a basic historical summary of Trash written, which I'm going to insert into this whole thing.
Yeah.
But maybe just in like a few sentences kind of encapsulate the, you know, just the basic shutdown of the store and the decision to, you know, take it out on the road.
Right.
You know, that's because that's what I want to focus on. Is that,
okay.
That sort of thing.
Are we rolling right now?
We're rolling right now.
All right. Well, basically, what happened to the brick and mortar version of Trash American Style was that after 21 years in business, 18 and a half of those years in the same spot on Mill Plain Road, we were informed by our landlord that our tenancy was no longer required. We had a neighbor who owned a print shop, and he had been trying to angle us out of there for about a year. And, you know, he offered to buy us out. We wouldn't sell. He then tried to buy the building just to get us out of there, but he was such an incompetent boob that he wasn't able to do that. So I guess he had a couple of sweetheart meetings with the landlord, and they discussed when our lease was going to be up. Turned out that it really wasn't that far in the future, so he just waited. And then when I went over to my landlord's at that god-awful diner that they operate, with a new lease in my hand, ready to renew, I said, okay, 10 more years? He said, no more years. I was like, oh, okay. And well, your arms are too short to box with God, essentially. So we packed up and shipped out. And we had already been doing a lot of on-the-road vending as was. You know, I always had my little circuit, always doing distro shows and things like that. And it was weird because I didn't really think of myself as being burnt out on retail, but it turned out that I was. Like, I will never forget waking up the next day after we had finally moved everything out. You know, I woke up with a start, oh my God, got it! Oh no, I don't. I don't have to go anywhere. I think I'll just go back to bed, which is what I did. And from that moment on, I just kind of decided to keep doing it on the road. And we sort of had it in the back of our minds that we would look for a new spot and do more brick and mortar. But as time went on and we began to enjoy our newfound freedom a lot, we just kind of sort of put it on the back burner and then off the stove and then in the fridge and then just kind of threw it out the back door into the compost heap. And we reached a real critical moment when we were clearing out a lot of our stuff that we had in storage. And I came across the cash register. And I looked over at Kath and I said, Catherine, are we going to sell this thing or keep it? And she said, sell it, and that was it. That was pretty much the Rubicon we crossed, and I really don't have any urge to open a store at all. Sorry, kids.
So this, as far as the radius of how far you you travel with the distros, I mean, you've been frequently, I see you in New York City, you know, other locations in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So how far and wide do your travels take you?
Pretty much, like if you were to take a compass and draw a circle around Danbury, anything within a 1.5 hour radius, and 1.5 hour drive I consider to be local. But there's certain special events I'll do, like there used to be a really hot record swap down in Washington, D.C. that I would travel down to. I still go out to Cleveland every year for the Devo fan convention, and that's always a great, great time. Essentially, if I have a place to stay and I can do something productive for a couple of days, I really don't mind going anywhere. I've got a permanent case of road fever. I love to travel. That kind of ties in with all the, you know, I'm playing an awful lot these days.
Right.
Maybe we'll address that later. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I just love to travel, and it's really, really great to roll into a town and be at an event where people are like, oh my God, it's vinyls. Getting used to the new lingo. Vinyls, wow, look, it's I've heard of this band, Led Zeppelin. Yeah, Led Zeppelin, they're awesome. My dad's got one of these, you know, and just like continuing to blow people's minds just in different spots on the map.
Vinyls, that's an expression I've had to grow used to that.
Yeah.
It sounds like some like a German or European like expressing.
So. Oh, yes, you have the vinyls.
The vinyls.
The vinyls, yeah.
So the... Not having the responsibility of the daily rigors of running the store has opened you up to do more musical pursuits.
Way.
Okay, so is there anything, you know, maybe run down what musical projects you have going on right
now?
Oh,
definitely. And one of the key reasons that I really kind of decided not to open up again was just because I get to do so much music now. I've always had various bands going on, but now I'm doing a lot. My main band is Ultra Bunny. Yes, Ultra Bunny. And since the store got shut down for us, we've recorded 2 full-length albums, 3 7-inchers. We've got another 7-inch in the can. We've played more shows in the last 4 years than we had in the previous 7. I mean, it's crazy. On top of that, I do a solo acoustic punk rock thing, just me and one guitar. I cover everybody from Black Flag to Dead Kennedys and Ramones, and I got lots of original stuff too, so I do like half covers, half originals. I've got a project studio band called BB Gun, which is like the more dark and introspective stuff. I've got a noise project called Infra Bunny, which is also all studio, and that's basically like soundscapes and noise sculptures and just weird sonic textures. I think that's it for now.
All of these projects, you do tour with them, or you know, what's essentially?
Ultra Bunny tours. Today is June 2nd, so as of this date, we're going out to Ohio at the end of July to play some dates. We're playing Bridgeport next week, New London the week after that. We're going back out to Ohio end of August. You know, cultivating contacts hither and yon. With the solo acoustic thing, I play anywhere that I possibly can. I just got my passport application because I played a few dates with this British guy named Tim Holehouse, Holehouse, who said, "Oi, mate," and I'm not going to try to duplicate his accent because it's futile. "Oi, mate, they would love you over there." So I was like, damn, why not? Why not? Passport application, take my guitar in a backpack and just go. I hope... fingers crossed to do that before the end of the year.
Oh, so there's some possible international travel looming ahead?
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. I've always wanted to do it, and I've never been able to do it. Now I'm able to do it. So, and that's why I'm telling everybody about it, because the more I talk about it, the more I'm going to have to do it. There's no backing out once I spread the word.
I think I have like 1 or 2 listeners in Europe, so.
Oh, cool.
Maybe.
Nice. Better watch out.
So Trash American Style, as well as other record stores, provided more than just a place to buy records.
Oh, yeah.
And this is like one of the key things that seem to be lacking, this community aspect of things.
Yeah.
Typically, these places were meeting places as well as places of commerce.
Right.
And the meeting and exchanging of ideas was probably equally as crucial as the actual selling of the products.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So do you think... What do you think is filling this void now that a lot of these brick and mortar stores are closing? And as far as like youth culture goes, do you see I see a void. Do you see anything filling that void?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think a lot of it depends on where you are. I mean, Danbury, for example, has always been really fortunate that this town's always had something, whether it was us or the Heirloom or Molten Java over in Bethel. There's, they come and go. They're not always permanent, but there's always been something and somewhere that people could go. The internet obviously doesn't do it. That does not count. That is not a valid substitute for face-to-face interaction in the slightest bit. I'd have to say nothing, really. And I really feel, I know, it's sad, isn't it? I feel really bad for people. People can badmouth Danbury all they want, but here we are in the parking lot of this awesome venue getting ready to see a really good show, and at least there's something happening. Go to Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania, and there's nothing happening. So I wish I could say that there was, but I don't think there is. And that's really the time when I feel really bad about not reopening, is the fact that I really miss that community aspect of it. Because you never knew who would walk in the door. You never knew what was going to be on somebody's mind. You never knew who was going to meet each other. Oh my God, I haven't seen you in years, that kind of thing. I really miss that.
In an overall, societal sense, do you see the erosion of these sort of community meeting points as a decay in our overall culture?
I think it's more like a pendulum, it's like an ebb and a flow. There's always going to be down times and up times. Cycles. Things always move in cycles. I mean, this society's been in a state of perpetual decay for, pick a year, pick a number. It's definitely a pack of dogs eating themselves, and it has been for quite a while. And it's always been this sort of underground thing that's kept, if there's been any sort of spark of life in this society, it's been here. Like what people like us and what we're doing musically and culturally and artistically, that has been the life of this society. And I've always maintained that anything good comes from the underground. It does not come from the top and trickle down. All you have to do is look at what is in the top 10 or top 40 and see who's prefab and who isn't, and you'll see who has artistic value and who doesn't. And in the top 10, there ain't much in the way of people who have come up from the underground. But, you can look around and you'll see people who, would have gotten beaten up 20 years ago for walking out in the street looking the way they do, but now it's completely accepted. That's the power of the underground and the ability to shape people's perceptions of fashion and art and culture. So screw society, man.
Now, as far as downloading records and whatnot, and some people look at it as stealing, some people look at it as promotion for their band, or getting people out to shows. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's really devolved. Let's say it's devolved into a really good means of promotion. The only people who are screaming about it being stealing or the major labels. And if anybody knows about stealing, it's the major labels. Talk about honor amongst thieves. Just speaking from my own personal experience as an artist, I find it damn near impossible to sell a CD at a gig, but people will come to my shows knowing my stuff because they might have seen a YouTube clip or, gone to my website and downloaded a track or something. And to me, that's okay, because yeah, it'd be nice to make the dough off the CDs, but the recognition is really, really cool. It makes it a lot easier to go to, Bethesda, Maryland, for example, and have somebody there who knows who I am. Maybe two people, but my God, somebody knows who I am. It's incredible. So I think it's like a real shift now in how, if an artist is gonna try to be self-sustaining, I think it's really shifting towards live performance and more away from product, unless you reach a certain level, which I know I'm not at yet, where people really just want to buy your stuff because they're that much of a fan and they'll plunk down the bread for a record or a CD. I think you really have to work to get up to that point.
Well, one of the, as far as talking about the live performance and being able to perform live and delivering the goods in that setting, you know, the master of that, James Brown.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you want to eat, you have to work.
Right.
So would you say that this sort of downloading culture is like forcing artists to work on their live performance as opposed to just being able to provide a slick recording or some sort of production?
Again, it's kind of hard to say. I think it depends on what the artist's work ethic is to begin with. I mean, you can get a lot of mileage out of being a mysterious hermit. You know, look at someone like Cat Power or Brian Wilson or Bonnie Prince Billy. You know, there's this whole mystique. And then you can go to the opposite direction of Road Dogs, you know, someone like Twisted Sister, who'll play anywhere at any time, or Cheap Trick, or myself for that matter, who just are willing to hit that stage and just have it. You know, maybe there's a lot more spectacle. You look at Lady Gaga and like what she does. I don't know if she does that strictly to keep the bread, you know, the butter on her bread, but she certainly does put butts in the seats. And I think the spectacle doesn't hurt. I don't know, I think a lot of it just has to do with innate charisma. Like either you got it or you don't. And if you don't have it, you have to work a lot harder to get your message across, to project like that. Some people don't have to. You know, they find it very easy to do so. And I think those are the ones who have real staying power.
One of the things that I've admired about what you've been doing in the last several years is, you know, the store closing. That could be a crucial blow to a lot of people. And a lot of store owners have gotten jobs at, you know, whatever, Trader Joe's, Target, given up their dream to do what they want to do.
Right.
So the sort of staunch individualism is something that is a trait that is an admirable trait, especially in today's society. So,
thank you.
What keeps you focused on that path, essentially? Like once the store closed, you know, what was the whole, you know, like what prevented you from getting a job at, say, Starbucks or something like that?
To me, it was never an option. Never an option. I worked a job, you know, up until the time I was 22 years old when I opened up Trash American Style. And then from after that, I worked a job for like maybe a year and a half part-time just to pay the basic bills and keep the store running. And I will never forget my last day on the job was at, I don't even remember what, it was some stupid drugstore. I used to be an inventory taker, you know, a little calculator on my hip and counting the beans. And I was at some stupid pharmacy. And I knew that was my last day. Like, I'd already given notice, and I said, I'm not coming back because, you know, my store is starting to happen and I ain't working here again. And I knew that was my last day, and I was never going to work a job again, period. Now, of course, I can't predict the future. You might find me, I can't say Borders anymore, but you might find me behind a Barnes & Noble counter or at the local gas station or digging a ditch somewhere. But as far as I'm concerned, it's just not an option. Like, I view that as failure, and I don't view myself as a failure. So I just know that I don't want to do that, so I'm not gonna. And I really, honest to God, wish more people would kind of view it like that. You know, like, you're not forced into doing anything, really. I mean, your circumstances might be dire, you might find yourself somewhere temporarily, or you might have to compromise for a little while, but those should, as far as I'm concerned, this is just the way I look at it, those should be temporary expedients. And once you're able to get over the hump and, you know, out of the trough, pursue your vision, whatever it is. Maybe you want to be an accountant, be the best accountant that ever lived, go for it. Just enjoy whatever it is you do and make your art your living. And that's the way I look at it. This is my art. This is what I do. I'm an unrepentant capitalist. I think capitalism is an art when it's done right. There's no reason why anybody should ever feel bad coming out of a transaction. Customer happy, seller happy. There's nothing wrong with that.
So at the root of this is basically not so much reacting to, you know, what, say, an economic situation might be dictating to you, but never losing sight of what your goal is on a more, say, quote unquote, spiritual level.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, definitely.
So that's the kind of the takeaway from that, then, I guess.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
Totally. I think calling it a spiritual thing is actually very accurate, because, you know, obviously a lot of thought goes into it, but the drive he said, beating on his heart, comes from within, you know. And just like all of my interactions with people over the years have always, I don't know, I've just always had that kind of bigger goal in mind, you know. I'm not just here, I never ever thought, hey, I'm here to sell you a record. You know, I'm the conduit to facilitate you getting what you want and what you need. A medium, really, nothing more than that. And I think that if there's any reason why I've been able to keep doing it all these years while others have fallen by the wayside, is because of that. Nobody ever once walked into Trash American Style looking for a Wide Awake record and had me try to force a Metallica record on them. It, hey, kid, you know, if you like Wide Awake, you'll love this. You know, it's like, no. No, no, no. You can't dictate to people.
And that really is one of the things that's lost in the internet purchasing sort of facelessness of buying records these days, is that, oh yeah, I want to go buy like a Dark Throne record, so I go to some distro and I buy it, but you might not know what's in the periphery.
Right.
You know, unless there was someone there to sort of have that conversation with you. About,
exactly.
If you like this, you might like this other thing.
And an algorithm on Amazon is not a good substitute for that, you know?
It's a little frightening, actually.
Yeah.
Mathematically, like, duplicated, having a real personal interaction with some sort of, you know, program or something.
Yeah, doesn't cut it. And I find that all the time, you know? One might get kind of jaded and think that, you know, the internet has taken the place of that personal interaction. Not at all. If anything, when I talk to people, they're like, man, it's just so great to actually talk to somebody about this, you know, like somebody who knows who Kate Bush is, or somebody who saw the Bad Brains, or,
yeah,
you know, whatever. I mean, the human element will never, ever, ever be replaced.
Well, there's also the intangible things of even just seeing a show flyer, like when you go to a record store, you know, you're going to buy, like, something that might not be related to that. You might be buying like a, you know, Mazzy Star record when you see a flyer for a Cro-Mag show.
Yeah.
You're like, well, wow, you know, what's this all about? So it broadens the, you know, the experience, just
definitely
having this physical place to go to.
Definitely. Like the oldest gatherings for humanity has always been the marketplace. The market is where humans have always congregated. And that's something else that I don't think is ever going to change. It's human nature. It's in our genes.
So you don't see millions of people sitting in front of these tiny screens wired together by this, you know, wireless network, a substitute for that?
Well, you know, I'm sure there's some governmental body somewhere that would like to force the issue, but if it does happen, I don't think people are going to go willingly. There's always a certain subset of people who have no social skills whatsoever, you know, for whom the internet is a real boon, but, you know, your average human being doesn't really want that.
Are you familiar with Ray Kurzweil?
No.
The singularity theories about like humanity and technology sort of, you know, melding together and reaching like a critical state.
Mm.
It's interesting because nowadays it really, he had all these predictions over the last 30 years about technology, and that's one of his predictions, is like the sort of singularity of technology and humanity. And I was curious if you'd heard about any of those theories and if you thought maybe you had a prediction about how far away we might be from something like that.
Well, it's another one of those intangibles, you know, you'd have to make something like that really attractive to, you know, everybody.
Right.
You know, not just the sociopaths or whatever. I wouldn't go out on a limb and try to predict that. I don't rule it out, but, you know, humanity. How do you predict what this mass of hairless monkeys is going to do from one minute to the next? Yeesh.
This is another kind of far out, unrelated question, but it is kind of related in a you know, more esoteric level, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to do with alien visitation and
sort
of. You know, I've been watching this documentary on Netflix called Ancient Aliens,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's all this quote unquote evidence of alien visitation to ancient civilizations and whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, all of these, you know, sort of alien embodiments have been humanoid in nature, okay?
Right.
Now, do you think that it would be possible, if there was such a thing as time travel, that these quote-unquote aliens are actually future humans visiting the past?
That's a theory. Yeah, good question.
You know, because if there was another sentient being from another universe, why would they be humanoid?
Indeed.
You know, why would they even be carbon-based?
Indeed. Yeah, it's a good one. I had never thought of it like that.
Yeah.
But I like it.
Yeah, you know, it's if you think about how, like, technology, how, like, even in the last, say, like, from the Wright brothers to 1968, in, like, basically 70 years, we went from flying these, like, cloth and wood contraptions into, like, landing on the moon.
Right.
So thousands of years down the line, it's not, unreasonable to think that man could, you know, harness time travel, you know,
yeah,
or something like that.
I don't rule it out at all. Are you a Doctor Who fan?
Oh, I love Doctor Who.
Well, all right, then. There could be Time Lords in our not ancestry, but further down in our family tree. Patrick Troughton, by the way, was the best Doctor.
I agree, yeah. I like him. There's like some newer ones which I haven't seen, like the more recent Doctor Who stuff.
Yeah, I kind of lost track after they reintroduced the series a few years ago,
yeah,
with the guy who looks kind of like you, as a matter of fact. And I thought that was a pretty good series, but after that, my guitarist loves Doctor Who. Like, really started a Doctor Who discussion group and all that, and he linked me to a website that had a complete history of Dalek props. And they're like, well, you see, this was the Mach 7 body with a Mach 1 head. And if you look at the back of it in this frame, you can see where the helmet was dented. That occurred in episode 6 of, I was like, and it's just page after page after page of Daleks and what they were made of. I mean, I'm not that far gone, luckily.
So essentially that's it. Do you have any like final words or, you know, sort of, you know, advice for our sort of lost generation, I guess? People, you know?
Well, if you're lost, what's going on, dude?
Have they opened doors yet for like A&M?
Not yet. I think 6:30 is the actual time. So yep, drink more Cokes. Well, first of all, don't drink Coca-Cola. Pure poison. Choose your mutations carefully, because everything you do is a mutation. You change yourself no matter what you do. So you have to choose those mutations very carefully. Take your time. It's never too late. It might seem like it is, but it's not. Be more than a witness. I always have to quote the immortal Al Flipside. Be more than a witness. And just find whatever your vision is, whatever your art is, and be prepared to bleed for it. And that's all I got to say.
Cool. Oh, one more thing. Have you seen that Reality 86 thing posted?
Yeah, I just saw that, actually.
Yeah, that was amazing, wasn't
it? Was pretty cool, yeah. I was last time I ever saw Flag was on that tour. And
up in Poughkeepsie or out in...
No, when I lived down south, I saw him in Miami Beach. Right. South Beach, as a matter of fact, before it was South Beach, you know? And that was the night after the skinheads beat up Ratman. It was pretty grim, actually. Henry had broken his hand punching one of them out, and everybody was in kind of a down mood. And they all stayed at my ex-girlfriend's apartment building, which used to be my apartment building, which ended up being Versace's mansion later. And it was just like the Mongol horde descending upon this beautiful, beautiful old replica of Christopher Columbus's mansion. And Henry slept in the truck in an alley in the back. They stayed over, ate all the food, and left. No goodbyes, no nothing. Just in and out and gone. What a way to run a ship, man. Tight.
Actually, when I think of Trash American Style, I often think of Black Flag, SST, and Charles Manson.
Oh, yeah.
Those are like the three biggest things for me from I got out of going to the shop.
Wow.
Most of the SST catalog, discovering bands like Slovenly and Sacred Trust, addition to, all the normal stuff, like Husker Du, Black Flag, Minutemen.
Right.
And also the exquisite collection of Charles Manson material that you had.
Yeah. To this day, I do Garbage Dump as part of my solo acoustic set. And it's really funny. It doesn't matter where I am or what kind of an audience it is. All I have to do is say, this song's by Charles Manson. And people just like, they react immediately and suddenly they're very much all ears. And some people think it's really funny. Some people, I haven't really had anybody object to it, but I've seen people like, you know, kind of like, ew, gross. But people usually like it. I think it's hilarious. It's a good song. I know that much.
Yeah. Have you seen the Jim Van Bever film, The Manson Family?
No.
I have to hook you up with that somehow. It's a very exhaustively researched Charles Manson pseudo-documentary. And it's, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Jim Van Bever, the filmmaker.
No.
He's not a household name by any means. You know, he's one of the things I'm attracted to his work is that it's completely independently financed. And it's all produced by him and his friends, essentially. Even the actors are like non-actors. Yet he's able to get some of the best performances out of non-actors that rival, you know, people you see like in that are trained, quote unquote, actors.
Right.
And he's done a bunch of shorts. He's done a couple of feature films, but by far, like, his life achievement to me was this 10-year process it took for him to make this Manson film. And you know, I think 2005 it had a screening, like a theatrical release, but it's available on DVD. And it's a pretty well researched representation of the whole lead up to the Tate LaBianca murders and, you know, all the characters and all this other stuff. So if you get a chance to check it out, it's definitely...
Yeah, I'd love to see it. The name's easy enough to remember, so that's cool.
Yeah,
just the fact that they had their own little society, and it was very, very rigidly structured with rules and theology. I mean, really incredible. It's not just your average, you know, hippie murder cult. There's a lot going on there.
Totally, yeah. One of the things that I keep reflecting on is the fact that, you know, Charlie was only out of jail for a few years in his adult life.
Right, you know? Right.
And he's been locked up for, he's got to be, in his 80s at this point?
At least his 70s.
Yeah. He's been locked up for decades. So those few years that he was out running wild and, out there in California, he must relive those moments every single day of his life.
Sure.
Because all his reality right now is a concrete floor.
Right. He really had it in the Summer of Love. And I always think about that, you know. What an incredible chance of fate that someone like Charles Manson was dumped into a place like San Francisco at a time like the Summer of Love. Like, what are the odds of that, you know? It's mind-boggling. And the way I introduce Garbage Dump when I play it is like, what if this song had come out as a single during the Summer of Love? What if? Oh, Garbage Dump, Garbage Dump. One shudders to think.
And and the thing is he could have disappeared and no one would have ever heard from him again, and he could have lived happily ever after.
Right.
But there's that criminal mentality, man.
Yeah.
That tragic flaw that just put him on that path.
Right.
You know?
Coupled with just the most random quirks of fate and chance meetings. I mean, what are the odds, you know, that he would have found, who was it? I forget who the first girl in the family was. He just had this way of finding these totally lost kids, and I guess because maybe he'd been a pimp and knew how to work the psyche of a young, confused girl. But guys, too, like, he could zero right in on what their weaknesses were and bring them in.
Sure.
You know, really, really incredible. And if he'd gotten out of jail a year earlier or a year later, everything would have turned out differently.
Totally.
You know, he probably would have sunk into obscurity because he wouldn't have had that sort of petri dish to cultivate in. Yeah, it really is something to meditate upon.
There seems to be a lot of books coming out, another resurgence in books, like Creation Books. They seem to be publishing a lot more Manson texts recently.
Huh.
A lot of them are just kind of retellings of stuff you've already seen, or like repackaging of existing material, you know.
But
there just seems to be like sort of a little bit more interest in Manson these days.
Yeah, the people have always been interested in Manson. I don't even know how many Manson t-shirts I had sold over the years, and, you know, all the cassettes and CDs and stuff like that. You ever read a book called Witness to Evil?
No, I haven't.
It's a stupid title, but it's the best book I've ever read about the trial.
Oh, okay.
It was written by a reporter, forget the guy's name. But, you know, everybody's read Helter Skelter, so you get the Bugs impression of how things went down. This guy pretty much plays it straight down the middle, and he tells it like it is, and it's a really, really revelatory
See, that's more what I'm after, is like an objective viewpoint on it rather than something colored by the prosecutor or,
Right. Witness to Evil. I wish they had given it a better name.
Yeah.
You know, but it really is a good book. Quite recommended.
I'd love to find that then.
Yeah.
Right, we'll have to roll.
Looks like we're
Thank
going in.
Thank you very much, sir.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll see you down the road. Man.
Right on.
Take care.
Sticking around?
Tonight's my parents' anniversary.